Hello, my name is Claire Armistead, and I'm the literary editor of The Guardian. One of the most pleasurable parts of my job is longlisting for the Guardian First Book Award, which is now in its 10th year. This year we had the biggest entry ever, 170 books, ranging from fiction to poetry, history, travel to memoir. After the 6 reading groups had been through them, that reduced to 5, 3 novels and 2 works of non-fiction. Each week in the run-up to the prize, we're interviewing a shortlisted author, and this week it's Alex Ross, music critic for The New Yorker, whose book The Rest is Noise is a huge history of 20th century music. Welcome, Alex. Perhaps saying it's a huge history might off-put the listener, when actually it doesn't read huge, it reads very easily.
Oh, well, I'm very glad to hear that. It's a little under 600 pages. It covers a huge territory, but I worked very hard to try to really keep the narrative moving along, not to overwhelm the reader with too many names, and there's not a lot of technical musical discussion in the book. And, you know, for that reason, I actually had to leave out a lot of great music and great composers, but there were certain ones who did really help me tell this rather dramatic story of composers interacting with the 20th century.
So you've taken very much a classical stand. That's the center of your music. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is a story of classical music. Not to say that this is the only important musical story to be told about the 20th century. Obviously, it's only part of a much bigger story. But for me, I find this particularly fascinating: how these composers experience this dramatic and often horrifying century. And throughout the book, I'm actually very interested in how the composers are interacting with figures in jazz in the 20s and 30s, or later in the 60s and 70s, when you find the minimalists Steve Reich and Philip Glass often sharing some of their language with the progressive rock bands of that era, the Velvet Underground and so on. So it's based on classical music, but it takes in a lot more in terms of what's going on in other areas of music and in the whole history of the century in general.
Yeah, I want to pick you up on that because a critic over here wrote that this book is as much a work of psychology or history as it is of criticism. And I wonder if you can give us a little bit of the history.
Right, well, I begin the book with this remarkable performance of Richard Strauss's lurid opera Salome, which happened in Graz in Austria in 1906, and a lot of his fellow composers were there, Puccini and Mahler and the radical young Schoenberg with all of his students. And then there was this rumor that Adolf Hitler, then aged 17, was also present at this performance. And, you know, right there, this was the perfect jumping off point for my book, because I wanted to have a sense of the larger and often darker landscape that these composers were part of. And of course, you skip ahead 30, 35 years, and you find Strauss enmeshed in the Hitler regime. You find Shostakovich entangled in Stalin's Soviet Union and the apparatus thereof. American composers interacting with the New Deal in America. So there's this constant drama throughout the century, which I think is very important to realize, because we think of classical music as somehow cordoned off from the rest of society, existing in its own rarefied world. But no, I mean, the composers really mattered in the bigger story of things. So that was maybe the most important story that I wanted to tell.
Mm. And of course, there are also personal stories that go into this. I mean, Schoenberg has a particularly fruity story, doesn't he?
Yes, well, it wasn't just a sort of an abstract exercise for him when he was abandoning so much of the language of music that existed up until the beginning of the 20th century and inventing this radical new language called atonality. I mean, there was this remarkable kind of chaos in his personal life, his wife having an affair with a painter who later committed suicide, and the psychological complexities of what was going on inside of him. So it wasn't a purely intellectual decision for him at all. It was kind of this very psychologically charged leap for him, and I think it becomes more understandable if you look at that sort of personal aspect of things and don't just see it as this a very sort of abstract, dry decision to sort of change the language of music.
Mm. And that may be, I think this sort of anecdotal richness is possibly why it's been such an incredible success. It has reprinted 7 times in the state. It sold about 70,000 copies in hardback, is that right? Or it's probably more by now, is it?
Somewhere on there. I don't have the latest figures, but yeah, it's somewhere between 60 and 70.
And of course, for our prize, it went out to 6 Waterstones groups around the country and also an online group, and they all heartily endorsed it, which seems an extraordinary achievement in an age in which classical music is said by a lot of people to be out of fashion.
Oh, well, I'm astonished and so grateful to see people outside of classical music responding to the book. I mean, of course, it's very flattering when experts people who already know the subject very well respond to it or take issue with it, as the case may be. But my ultimate goal was really to reach those readers who aren't well versed in the subject and to let them know how passionately I feel, first of all, about classical music itself and how it does matter. It's something that any intelligent, cultured person should know about, but particularly this music, the 20th century, which for a lot of classical listeners is sort of the mysterious, difficult area, but I just feel so strongly that this is some of the greatest music from all of history, and I think it is slowly really being absorbed into the larger repertory.
And also all arts, actually, because you make this nice point that Jackson Pollock, John Cage and Morton Feldman used to hang out together in New York, and yet abstraction in art has been accepted in a way that it hasn't in music.
Yeah, this is a big mystery, I think, which for decades now people in classical music have been mystified why, Picasso and Kandinsky and Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko should draw these huge crowds at museums when exhibitions of their work are put on, and yet there's sort of murmurs of anxiety and sort of half-empty halls when it's Schoenberg or Stockhausen or Morton Feldman in the concert hall. So there's some kind of mysterious disparity there, and it's partly understandable just because how we listen is rather different from how we look and how we read, and it's a more, in a curious way, sort of a more emotional and visceral activity. So someone who may be quite open-minded about what's going on in painting may just react differently to music. But I think you can really train yourself almost to listen to this music differently if you find something out about the context and what drove these composers to create these sounds. And
for example, Shostakovich was uncomfortable in his times, wasn't he? And talk a bit about him, how that translated into his music.
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, this is a composer who has achieved considerable popularity with audiences. I think partly because people do identify with the sort of remarkable emotional richness and these shades of ambiguity in his music, these triumphs that somehow fall short, and these gray states of mind that are sort of somewhere between, the sort of the tragic and the joyous. And, of course, we can't really put ourselves in his position, being this kind of hero of Soviet art who was constantly terrified of everything being taken away from him and, who was forced to endure these strange phone conversations with Stalin where, if he uttered, the wrong word, something awful could have happened to him. We can't put ourselves in that position. But this deeper ambiguity, the sense of, where do I belong in this modern world, and something far beyond a kind of a purely black and white emotional condition, all these shades of gray, this is something I think we can identify with. So there is something very, very universal about Shostakovich's emotional complexity.
So now, it's been said that every generation produces its classical critic, and you are that critic for this generation.
Well, I don't know, but...
You blush. I can hear you blushing. Where did it come from? Do you come from a musical family?
Both my parents are actually geologists. They didn't have musical training, but they were classical music lovers. I mean, they just had a big record collection, mostly of 18th, 19th century music. They've never been fans of the 20th century, ironically, but they exposed me to classical music at a very early age, and I took to it. I started studying piano and trying to compose at a pretty early age. I gave that up pretty much by the time I got to college, since the lack of talent was becoming pretty obvious. But I just immersed myself in it.
And, you didn't read music, did you, at the university?
No, I actually ended up majoring in English, though I took some music classes and spent a lot of time at the college radio station. That was sort of my unofficial major, doing a 20th century music show, and that's how I kind of tilted toward writing about music while I was doing that show. And after college, I took on a few freelance assignments, assuming that I'd end up in grad school and in an academic career. But to my surprise, I found you actually might be able to make a living writing about music, sort of, you know, immersing myself in what I loved. So I feel I'm very, very lucky that way, that it kind of ended up, you know, that career opened up for me.
So now you also, I think this is possibly relevant to the fact that you are an English graduate, is you, I mean, the forms of writing have been very important in your particular character, the character of your writing. In particular, you have a very well-read blog, don't you? Which came first?
The blog, the book was, I'd been working on it for years and years, and had titled it "The Rest Is Noise." I think as early as 1998, 1999. I started the blog in 2004 at a time where I actually believed I was almost finished with the book. It took three more years after that before it was actually done. The blog turned into a wonderful outlet. Actually, as I was cutting the book, and it was the initial draft was twice as long as the final published version, if you
Goodness.
Can believe that. I was actually taking some bits and pieces of what I had to cut and putting it on the blog, so I wouldn't lose it forever, and it helped with that process. But I also just started observing what was going on, you know, other blogs, classical blogs exploding, and kind of interacting with them and seeing how the internet was going to become a wonderful new outlet for classical music, as, you know, unfortunately the attention in the regular media has declined, not The Guardian, I have to say, but of course here in America many newspapers have been cutting back their critics, and it's something of a crisis. So the internet has really helped with that and allowed the conversation about classical music to continue.
And this is the million-dollar question, really. Would it have been the same book if the internet hadn't existed? Is that part of what you are as a critic? You're a critic of a new era of information gathering?
I don't know. That's hard to say. I mean, the book itself is pretty traditional. I think I ended up writing it pretty much the same way I would have, before the internet existed or became an outlet for music. But at the same time, I think the fact that I've had the blog and drawn an internet readership, I think has helped enormously. And particularly after the book has come out, I've used my blog to provide additional information. I think most importantly with sound samples, I now have somewhere around 300 1 minute or 2 minute, sometimes a little longer, musical examples for people to listen to as they read the book. It's therestisnoise.com/audio. And I think this really has demystified my material for a lot of readers who don't already know it, and just to be able to catch an oral glimpse of what I'm talking about can make a lot of difference.
I have to say, I've given your book to a couple of friends for big birthdays, and I've given them you have a discography, some recommended CDs, which actually I haven't necessarily been able to get the recordings, but I have given them the book with some recordings, and it's been a fantastic hit as a birthday present. One last question is, are there any regrets about things that you had to leave out? I mean, do you feel that, for example, you perhaps didn't include as much popular music in some areas as you would have liked to have?
Oh, no, I don't regret that. I mean, popular music is such a vast subject that I couldn't possibly take it on. I also didn't grow up with pop music. I really only started listening to it in college. I was really kind of a little narrow-minded that way when I was a kid, and I was just purely devoted to classical music. So I'm not the person to write the big sprawling history of pop music in the 20th century. And there was so much going on in classical music that there was just no way I could take that in as well. It would be a great book if someday someone tried to write, you know, the whole history of popular and classical music together, but it would be a very tall order. I mean, of course, I have intense regrets about what I had to leave out in the classical area, and I couldn't overwhelm the average reader with too many names, too many examples. So this is, as I said, just a beginning, and, you know, I certainly hope that people go out and explore more and more of this music.
That's fantastic, and we very much look forward to the next book, and I look forward to seeing you at the awards ceremony in December. I do hope you'll come.
Yes, I certainly hope to, yes.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Thanks, Claire.